This week, there was a stunning dismissal of the involuntary manslaughter charges against actor Alec Baldwin. As you recall, there was a fatal shooting on the set of the movie Rust, and he was charged. The charges were dropped, and they were brought again. He was on trial, and the judge dismissed the case. With us here on WGN to break down the legalities, what happened here, is one of my favorite criminal defense lawyers in the city, Damon Sharonis. He's the founder of Sharonis, Parente, and Levitt. He's a very fierce advocate for people accused of federal white-collar violent crimes, drug and sex crimes. He's been involved in some of the city's highest profile cases, and he even represented the film mogul Harvey Weinstein. Welcome to the show, Damon. Always a pleasure to have you. How are you?
Happy Sunday, Karen. Thanks for having me.
So let's just tell the listeners just briefly what Alec Baldwin was charged with, just to set the background here.
Sure. So he was charged on the shooting that occurred on the set of the movie Rust, and essentially he was charged with involuntary manslaughter, which is basically what we refer to as reckless homicide, when you take a course of action that is done recklessly with, you know, taking unjustifiable risks and things like that. And that's what he was charged with.
And let's so he gets to trial and the judge dismisses the case. And I have a little audio of the judge. Can you play that, Jack?
Per State versus Lemire, where discovery violations inject needless delay into the proceedings, courts may impose meaningful sanctions to effectuate their inherent power and promote efficient judicial administration. The state's discovery violation has injected a needless, incurable delay into the instant jury trial. Dismissal with prejudice is warranted to ensure the integrity of the judicial system and the efficient administration of justice. Your motion to dismiss with prejudice is granted.
Pretty dramatic event in court when you have your case dismissed with prejudice. And before we get into a lot of the details, can you just tell our listeners what it means with prejudice?
When you dismiss a case with prejudice, it means that the state cannot retry Mr. Baldwin for that crime. If it was without prejudice, they could. That would have just been a mistrial. But the judge took the most drastic sanction that you can levy upon the government, and that's to dismiss the case outright. And I'll just say that, good for her. You know, defense attorneys around the country are giving a standing ovation, because believe it or not, this stuff happens. And it happens, I think, a lot more regularly than maybe the public knows about. I mean, I more often than not, I'm getting late discovery in cases, or, you know, the government, and I'm not saying it's always intentional, you know, they'll find something a week before the trial. I've had disclosures mid-trial, and it's very rare for a judge to take this hard of a stance, but good for her, because she's right. There was no other remedy at this point for what happened.
And I want to get into this a little more detail than we normally would, because it is very interesting. And I just want to ask you, Damon, how often do you see this happen? I mean, you've been a lawyer for a lot of years. Have you ever seen a judge dismiss a case because the state didn't turn over certain evidence?
You know, I was racking my brain to see if that had ever happened in one of my cases, and I don't think it has. But it does happen sometimes, but it's drastic. And one of the reasons is, just to be candid, you know, and this is unfortunate, and I don't mind saying it, is, you know, prosecutors get a whole lot more rope than defense attorneys do. And, you know, oftentimes, and I've seen it happen, I saw it happen in the Weinstein trial, judges sometimes bend over backwards. You know, because there were some late disclosures in that case. And it's very easy for a judge to say, well, no, I'm not going to dismiss the case. Shame on you, prosecutor. Don't do this again, or I'm going to give you an adverse jury instruction. So this is not something that happens with regularity. But in a situation like this, I think it was so glaring that the judge, you know, did the right thing. You know, she said the integrity of the judicial system. And we think of those words, and they're these sort of highfalutin words, but she meant it, and she was right. This isn't a game. You know, whether you like Alec Baldwin or not, you know, he was facing 18 months in jail. He had very good lawyers. And it wasn't even the lawyering, really. I mean, this was disclosed late. They found out about this late. And he has a right to a fair trial and the right to favorable and exculpatory evidence. pursuant to the Brady versus Maryland decision, and that has to be turned over. And, you know, I don't want to be on a soapbox, but, you know, prosecutors just need to play fair, and most of them do. But when they don't, you know, things like this are going to happen.
Well, and it seems to me that if you give them a slap on the wrist and say, next time, you know, that's a problem, you know, when something like this happens, I would imagine that the prosecutors in this Santa Fe area are going to say, whoa, we better get our act together and get the discovery over as quickly as possible so this doesn't happen again. And, you know, so then you get better justice, you get better and more fair adjudications. And that makes sense to me. But let's take a break because I want to talk.
Go ahead. Well, I'm a defense attorney, so I'm always sort of oftentimes rooting for the defense. But think of how the victim's family feels, right? I mean, that's another thing. You know, when the prosecutors do things like this, it's not just the defendants who suffer. You know, what a jury was going to decide whether he was reckless or not. Maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. But because of, you know, what they did, that family didn't get to hear a verdict from a jury who heard all the evidence because the government was found to essentially have been cheating in the case. And that's serious stuff.
Yeah, I could see them getting very angry about that, because sometimes that's the only closure a family gets, is a verdict against the person who they think did it. So, you know, you're absolutely right to look at this as a victim's issue. Let's come back and talk a little bit about exactly what the prosecution didn't turn over and exactly what the law is about these kinds of things. We're talking to Damon Sharonis. He is with the firm of Sharonis, Parente & Levitt, one of the best criminal defense lawyers in the city, and you're listening to WGN. If you have any questions about the Alec Baldwin case this week, give us a call here. We've got Damon Sharonis. He's a fantastic criminal defense lawyer here in Chicago, 312-981-7200. Damon, let's talk a little bit more about this evidence that the prosecution didn't turn over. To your understanding, what didn't the prosecution do here?
So it's a little convoluted, but, you know, and I've looked into it. What had happened is the prosecution, or at least initially the sheriff's department, came into possession of live rounds of ammunition. I think an armor dropped it off there, and the idea was that could have pointed to a potential external source of what the actual live ammunition was in the case, not what the government was going with, right? So we set up a situation where the sheriff's office and the prosecutors are in possession of evidence that the defense needed to test, to look at, to determine, you know, which bullets were used in the shooting, things like that, that they just didn't turn over. There's a question as to whether they, quote, buried it. The judge came very close to making a finding that they did, but essentially they had evidence that should have been given to the defense pre-trial so the defense could determine the extent to which this was helpful to the case. And the court made a ruling that it was material and that they could not test it this late in the game. So that's essentially what the crux of the Brady violation was.
And so, and can just tell our listeners what Brady means, just very basically.
Sure. Brady is the Supreme Court case, Brady versus Maryland, and it stands for the proposition that criminal defendants must be given any evidence that is potentially exculpatory or impeaching that is in the government's possession or could reasonably be obtained by the government. If they have something that could help the defense, they have to turn it over. That's the rule.
And so there was another issue with this firearm. The firearm that was actually used in the shooting was damaged by the prosecution while they were testing it. Do you know about that? Is that a big problem?
I mean, certainly. I mean, if the way I understand it is that there was an issue as to whether or not Alec Baldwin pulled the trigger or not. I believe he was saying he didn't. And then there are, you know, experts saying the gun had to have, the trigger had to be depressed for it to be fired. The government does their testing. Oh, sorry, defense team, you can't do a test because we destroyed the gun, which is pretty weird. I mean, in a lot of cases that I've been involved in, the government will test DNA evidence, right? And they'll tell me in advance, look, you know, if we test this evidence, it's going to be consumed and you're not going to be able to test it. And that gives me the opportunity to say, well, I want, you know, we'll talk about this. Maybe I'll have my expert do it. And that's a normal thing where DNA gets consumed. But how a gun gets destroyed in the testing phase raised a lot of questions, and it put the defense in a difficult position because one of the most important pieces of evidence could not be tested by their own experts.
Absolutely. I don't know if it's because Baldwin had really good lawyers. I don't know if it's because Santa Fe is a smaller venue and maybe they're not used to the scrutiny that these lawyers put the prosecution to, but it seems like there were a lot of missteps here. I mean, there was a special prosecutor appointed who happened to be a legislator, which was a conflict of interest, and they charged Baldwin with crimes that they couldn't. And then they dropped the charges and then they brought him again. And, you know, to me, like when I see that, I think to myself, if the prosecutors had reasonable doubt about the charges, like what's the jury supposed to do?
Yeah, absolutely. And it doesn't just happen in small jurisdictions. I mean, it happens all over the place. And, you know, again, you know, I would not sit here and say that prosecutors are sitting back, you know, rubbing their hands saying we're going to hide this stuff. But what was really sort of problematic in this case is what it seemed that I saw. I watched a little bit of the hearing where the prosecutor actually testified, which was bizarre. And
yes.
And you're right, Baldwin has really good lawyers. I would have been much harder on her if I was cross-examining her. I give him props for not going after her too much because I think he had already known he had made his points. But what she told the court essentially was that she made the unilateral decision that this evidence was not discoverable. That's a problem, right? When you have an adversary, a prosecutor who was looking to convict Alec Baldwin, look at a picture of the bullets and said, well, they're not the same as the ones on Rust, so therefore I'm not going to turn it over. That shows bad faith, and that shows hubris on the part of the prosecution that they're going to be the gatekeeper of what a defense attorney might think is necessary to defend his client. And this judge did a great job of calling her on the carpet and saying, not going to happen in my courtroom.
And there was a prior ruling that I really thought was really good for Baldwin. And again, without getting too much into it, my understanding is that there were kind of two aspects for Baldwin's involuntary manslaughter charges. One is him handling that gun and actually having it fire and kill the victim here. But also, in his role as producer, there was some idea that he was being reckless in how he conducted the set, and in that maybe he didn't hire or monitor the armorer correctly, or he didn't make sure that there was no bullets on set. And earlier, just I think maybe a week before the trial, the judge threw out that portion of it, what didn't allow the jury to hear that. Do you think that that ruling would have really made it harder to convict Baldwin?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, you know, when you have the recklessness for his direct actions, that's one area of it. But when you start going into his role as a producer, right, you sort of bring in more things, the case gets bigger, and you can sort of look at more things that he may have done. So that would have been a broader basis to convict him. So, and the judge made the right ruling. That was too attenuated, and, you know, good for her again.
And finally, the armorer, her name is Hannah Gutierrez Reed. She was convicted earlier in the year of involuntary manslaughter, and she was sentenced to 18 months in prison. And she, as soon as her conviction happened, she was taken away in handcuffs, and she's serving her time. What do you think about this ruling from the judge and how it might impact that conviction?
So I had, you know, and again, I watched a little bit of this, and I think the defense at her trial was that the gun worked perfectly and there was really no issues with the ammunition. So I don't know necessarily, but I'll say this. A lot of it's going to have to do with the timing. When did the government get their hands on this evidence? And it very well may have been after her trial had already started or after she was convicted. But if I'm her attorney and the government got their hands on this evidence prior to her going to trial, I'm filing the same motion. I'm filing a motion to dismiss with prejudice for Brady violations. There's already been a record made on this issue. Certainly, the cases aren't completely the same, so there may be some nuances, but if she's doing 18 months, you've got nothing to lose by filing a swift motion to dismiss for the same reasons.
Damon, can you hang with us until about quarter till?
Sure.
Okay. I know you have a lot of kids to attend to, so and a wife.
Yeah, they're at a graduation party, so I'd much rather keep talking to you.
Okay. That's good. I know you pick your poison, right? Before we take a break here, I know you represented Harvey Weinstein in the New York case. That case was overturned on appeal. Can you tell our listeners very quickly what the basis of the overturning was?
Sure. So, during trial, we had, objected essentially, to use a legal term, through the roof about a lot of the court's rulings. Mainly, the reversal was based on Judge Burke allowing into evidence what is called in New York Molyneux evidence. That's the name of the case. And essentially what that just means is he allowed the government to call a number of witnesses, a number of alleged victims who were not charged in the case, to essentially show what the government claimed was Mr. Weinstein's pattern, right? And the law in New York was pretty clear on that he was not supposed to do that. So essentially, the court just let the government call all of these witnesses that really didn't have anything to do with the case. And the Supreme Court of New York said, you're only doing this to show that he's a bad person, or that you think he's a bad person, that these people think he's a bad person. And this evidence was highly prejudicial, should have never been introduced, and it violated his right to a fair trial. That was the main basis of reversal in the case.
And, just not to get too much in the weeds, but most people think this. If you are accused of raping a woman, why wouldn't five other women who also claim they were raped be able to testify? Because doesn't a juror get to know that this guy rapes? This is what he does. Why does that get excluded in a case in New York like that?
Well, in Illinois, the law is different, right? There are different rules, and it's easier to get that type of evidence in. And I agree with New York, because the problem is that the evidence is so overwhelming that a jury is not going to be able to focus on the charged conduct. They're going to sit back and say, well, if five or six people come in, he must be guilty of what he did in the charged case. So the prejudice is just too much. And again, there's a give and take. People forget that defendants have rights too, right? It's not just looked at through the prism of the alleged victim. You have to look at a defendant's right to due process and to be, charged, and the evidence to be based on the charges in the case, or else it's unwieldy. And where do we stop? These are not character assassination trials. These are trials based on evidence. And the rules are meant to sort of protect that. One more thing about Weinstein. The government was allowed to call an expert witness, and that expert witness gave her opinion about a number of sort of the issues in this case, which bolstered the government's case. And I think that strikes the right balance. You let the state do that, but you can't just parade in all of these people for uncharged conduct, because that's just too prejudicial and it eviscerates his right to a fair trial.
When we come back, let's talk.
I'm in an appellate court right now.
Yeah, that's right. Let's talk about Epstein a little bit when we come back from our break. Damon Sharonis, how can people get a hold of you?
My website, SharonisLaw.com, throw up the bat sign, whatever.
Great. And his name will be on the WGN podcasted segment shortly after the show. We'll come back. We'll be talking to Damon Sharonis a little bit about this Jeffrey Epstein spilling of documents that to me are a little stunning again on WGN. I'll be taking your legal questions about 4:45. We have plenty of time to get a bunch of questions in. Give us a call here now, and we'll get you all set up with my producer, who's going to take your facts and put you on hold, and then we can get to your questions. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. We're here talking to Damon Sharonis, a criminal defense lawyer with Sharonis, Parenti, and Levitt. Damon, did you follow this, what happened with the Jeffrey Epstein documents that were released this past week?
Yeah, I did. I did read about it, Karen.
Okay. So can you tell our listeners a little bit, as we all know, he died in prison. There was a question as to whether it was a suicide or not. It was ruled to be a suicide. He was there on charges of sex trafficking. But there were charges prior to this in 2006 that he was trafficking young girls. And I think, was it DeSantis actually signed an order in Florida to have these documents released? How unusual is it that these grand jury documents have been released?
It's very unusual. Grand juries are secret proceedings. That's what they're referred to as. They're pretty much run by the prosecutors. The prosecutors can call witnesses, subpoena evidence. And most grand jurors are told that other than the attorneys who can review it, that this is not going to be disclosed. It's almost a sacred thing where you don't release the transcript, which is why DeSantis actually had to sign a law. So it's not something that happens very often.
So a bunch of documents were released. And to your knowledge, what did these documents show?
Well, I mean, you know, there's been a lot of uproar, and rightfully so, over maybe the handling of the case in Florida initially. So what these documents show, and I haven't read the actual documents, but what they show is that the state attorney's office in, I think, Palm Beach County had a lot of evidence regarding significant allegations of sexual abuse from minors that allegedly Epstein perpetrated. And despite having that live testimony, they did not sort of indict him on the types of charges or get convictions or see convictions on the types of charges that grand jury testimony would support. So it certainly, you know, it adds to the questions regarding how that case was resolved.
And, you know, I did, you know, see the summaries of some of the testimony. But, you know, there's like a girl who was 14 and they were questioning her. Well, do you know that by taking money for having sex, that was a crime and that's prostitution? As a lot of like what I would call victim shaming, you know, as opposed to the idea that a 14-year-old can't consent, you know, under the law. It just, you know,
absolutely,
the whole thing just strikes me. And, you know, they reduced charges. I don't know exactly what the end charges were. I think it was like just mere prostitution or something. But he served, I want to say, 13 months in prison, and he was allowed to leave the prison and go and work at his Palm Beach office. I don't know that I've ever seen a serious case like this, and it was serious, not being taken very seriously. Is there any explanation? I mean, you know, conspiracy theories abound when it comes to him, and I think the plot gets thicker here.
Yeah, I think regarding the grand jury and the questioning of the witnesses, there's, you know, a couple schools of thought regarding that. One is sometimes prosecutors are concerned that they're going to get a motion to dismiss from the defense for grand jury misconduct. In other words, you know, if they put somebody in the grand jury and they don't get out sort of some of the bad information, the defense might make a big, you know, big issue with that. Or if that witness was to testify at trial, you could cross-examine the witness and say, well, when you were in front of the grand jury, you were not asked this question, you didn't reveal this. That's one reason, possibly. You know, I can't even begin to think of what another reason would be. You know, I don't want to get into the cabal of conspiracy theories,
right,
on this.
Right.
So, you know, that's one idea. But yeah, I mean, I think the plot always is going to thicken in the situation, from how he died to why he wasn't charged more seriously to everything that is alleged to have occurred after he got this deal, right? Because all of the allegations, really, or most of them, I should say, you know, took place after that period of time. So yeah, that's a big question mark that's looming out there still.
Yeah, it's one of those things that probably after we're all dead, that the documents are going to finally surface, and then we'll finally know. This is just,
well, we won't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
We'll already be dead.
Yeah, and and maybe Ghislaine Maxwell, when she gets out of her 20-year sentence, will finally write the book or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
This is apropos of nothing, but a listener said was interested in the Jussie Smollett case, and we weren't scheduled to talk about it, but she asked what the status was. And my understanding is that the Illinois Supreme Court decided to take the case to determine whether or not Smollett, the charges that were dropped against him and then rebrought, if that was proper. If, you know, Damon, if the Illinois Supreme Court takes the case, and I think they took it like in March or May of this year, how long do you think it will take them to rule on that, and that we'll have a final ruling from the Illinois Supreme Court?
Well, two issues. One, the Supreme Court doesn't take a lot of cases, right? When you lose an appeal, you have to file a petition for leave to appeal to the Supreme Court of Illinois, and then they get to choose. So I'm sure Smollett's lawyers are excited about this, because oftentimes when a case like this goes up and the Supreme Court takes it, you know, you think, for better or worse, that you're going to get a reversal. Same thing with Weinstein. We were very excited when his case was taken by the New York Supreme Court, and it worked out for us. You know, when it's going to happen, who knows? You know, appellate courts can take a long time. They can be quick. I'm not sure if there's a definitive, schedule. I don't know if the briefs have all been filed, or even if there's been, is there an oral argument yet? You know, usually it'll be some months after the oral arguments are done.
Yeah, I would say probably it's going to be a year from when they took it. So maybe late this year or early next year would be my guess. Again, you're right.
That saga never ends either, Karen.
It's just going to keep on going. Damon Chirotas, yeah. Thank you so much for joining us here. Damon Chirotas is founder of Chirotas, Parenti & Leavitt, really a criminal defense law firm in Chicago that you need to know. Thanks for joining us, Damon. Take care. Enjoy the rest of your summer.
All right, Karen, take care. Talk soon.